Welcome back to Pax Europiana, to the debate about peace in Europe, how to develop our peace order in Europe in the coming years. And this is now the episode about the second part of the Putin's Cold War. And this is the period from his consolidation in power towards basically until the third presidency, the start of the third presidency. So I will cover basically this period from 2000 to 2012, yeah, in this second part. Maybe you have listened already to the first introduction about the 90s and all these things. That would be useful. And now I will explain again. It was a consolidation in the beginning, obviously. It was complicated also for him to be the prime center of power as a relatively young man, unknown. Obviously, he had to establish himself at home, and he has to establish himself abroad. And the world was anyhow very busy with the tragic events of September 11, and then the Afghanistan and Iraq war. And he somehow tried to play along. He made this famous appearance in the German parliament, promising a free trade offer, a free trade area until Vladivostok. And he tried to make friends. He met famously with George Bush on the Slovenia meeting, looking in the eyes, seeing his soul, and all these things. Also, the West was interested in order to have no chaos, no conflict, and focus on Afghanistan, Iraq, and the fight against terror, the war against terror. Obviously, that was the most dominating issue of the 2000s. Obviously, we were also very divided about the decision to go to Iraq. You remember Chirac and Schröder opposing it, Europe completely divided. We were again a complete mess. And so it was wonderful basically for Putin to travel around, make friends, and continue to consolidate power. Only a few were really concerned by this major transformations of economic power in Russia and his methods which he deployed, especially the Yukos affair. Some might remember it. It was, of course, dramatically how this power struggle was going from sector to sector, from area to area, from media to the oil industry. And by 2004, he more or less won his internal power struggle, and he dominated the politics and the economics of his own country. But in that process then, he was, of course, totally surprised by the development, obviously not taking Europe very seriously, not taking NATO so seriously at that moment. But parallel to all these things happened, of course, NATO and EU enlargement. And in 2004, in March, was this enlargement for seven countries. Basically, most of the Central and Eastern Europeans who joined NATO, they were also prior in EU in order to coordinate these memberships. And so what happened on 1st of May 2004, the 10 countries joined the European Union. Only Cyprus was a special case. It didn't join NATO before because of a Turkish veto situation. So, but all of others, they have joined NATO before, and then that's also the decent process. So suddenly, in a way, a new geostrategic situation has materialized. Obviously, it was not suddenly. It was happening already 15 years before and the fall of the Cold War. It just took some time to prepare membership and to get everybody convinced and to prepare the countries for that one, build a consensus. But in 2004, it materialized. Obviously, this led to this Rose Revolution and also to the Ukrainian Orange Revolution. I've already talked a bit about it, but the spillover effect of good things is going very fast, also of negative things. Because, you know, we are in one media environment, people have relatives and friends, and they watch the media of other countries, and they simply compare each other. For example, the Ukrainians, they know Poland, they work there, they understand, or they know Lithuania very much. Yeah? They understand that Lithuania was with them in the Soviet Union and suddenly was in NATO and in EU. And especially Lithuania played a really big role at the end of the Soviet Union, with this 13th of January protests and the suppression of it and the leadership against it. And there was always a little bit of a competition in the ex-Soviet Union, who is really the country which brought down the Soviet Union in a way, between the Lithuanians and the Georgians. There's also others who have contributed, but these two ones were really the leading countries. So Georgians saw, oh, we are 2003, we still have Shevardnadze and all these problems and this chaos and poverty, while Lithuania is now a NATO and EU member. I mean, it must be not only envy, but also surprise, in a way, for the Georgian public that this kind of progress was possible. They wanted the same. And with Shakishvili, they had a leader who is incorporating or symbolizing this kind of progress. And so they went for these protests against the election result. And then came the transformation and all these reforms which have transformed Georgia extremely positive in the last 15 years. And it's amazing. And obviously, you know, I'm very much in favor of Georgia adopting the euro, joining NATO and the EU and all this in the 2020s. But you have maybe listened already to the specific podcast about that one. So this was, of course, wow, a big shock, because after consolidation back home, Putin said, oh, it's all mine, it's all good, and now I take care of my near abroad and the ex-Soviet Union. Yeah, but they have lived on and time has passed. So ultimately, they were already on a total different world. Three of them in NATO and EU, the Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia, and Georgia in revolution against a Soviet-style personality of first class. Yeah? Shevardnadze, please, was the foreign minister of Gorbachev. I mean, you cannot be more Soviet than Shevardnadze. And then it was like this, that there was this revolution. Things turned sour, and of course Georgia and Ukraine from the Russian perspective, and Georgia and Ukraine are very connected. People go to holiday there. The Ukrainians, Georgia is like, for the Austrians, Italy or Croatia. It's like you know these places, you know the holidays, you love it, you want to go there in the summer, you're really interested in the music and in the culture, and you love all this entertainment there. And similar, it's for the Ukrainians to go to Georgia. They love the food, they love the dances, and they love the people. And they spend the winter and the summer holidays there. So it's a very big interconnection. And obviously, they were in the Soviet Union already together. So there was a close link between the people, and there was, of course, an overlap. Once the revolution happened there, and the people in Western Ukraine, especially watching Polish television, seeing NATO membership already since 1999 and EU membership really happening May 2004. And they were still in this kind of disaster of a post-Soviet Union, badly managed crisis status. And then they had these fake elections. And then they started to protest. And then came the Orange Revolution. And so Putin has lost it's kind of, in his world, his second proxy, his second colony in a year. Of course, you know, that was really big shock. Yeah? And obviously then, from then on, the alarm bells in Moscow was ringing, and the whole machinery which took power in Russia was then used to retake the power in Ukraine. In Georgia, they tried as well, but it is, of course, a smaller country, less significant and less border direct with Russia, and you know, it was not the number one priority in the beginning, but it became a very big priority later. So now it was, of course, Ukraine. What to do? And obviously, there's a lot of economic links, a lot of people have mutual investment, friendship. So he started to mobilize all his effort to block the progress of the Orange Revolution, to make friends in Europe, to avoid that Ukraine gets any European perspective, and to do everything the Russian state and the Russian security apparatus could do internally, externally, in Ukraine, in Europe, in America, to make sure that the Ukrainian experiment of Orange Ukraine, a pro-European Ukraine, will fail. He went so far to poison the Ukrainian president, Yushchenko. You remember his face when he was in Vienna, this totally disastrous of this nuclear poisoning? I mean, nuclear poisoning is a good topic. It will come up very often in the Russian tools in the Second Cold War. But this was the test case, yeah? In Austria, luckily, the president was saved. His health was re-established, yeah? But still today, his face is scarred by this terrible poisoning. So situation is that they were really going very far, and they were determined. Yeah, they were determined to get Ukraine back into the Russian world. Yeah, and we in Europe, I'm apologizing. We were determined not to get involved. Yeah, because you know, of course, everybody did some handshakes and applauded. Yes, but the Europeans were busy with the, in a way, digesting the enlargement of the 10 countries. Then was also Romania and Bulgaria, which are more complicated tasks. They were also in the pipeline, so that was already clear in 2004. So nobody really wanted a big conflict with Putin, because Putin went around, promised things, talked about peace, made friends, was really nice to very unimportant Austrian or Luxembourgian politicians, shared presents, and to showed himself in generally from the most splendid side, if you were doing what he wanted. Yeah. And that was exactly the situation about this Austrian EU presidency 2004, and the situation in this difficulty, it was 2006, yeah? And then it was exactly this timing when the decisions were made about Ukraine getting, Orange Ukraine getting a EU candidacy or some kind of perspective or not. Obviously, it didn't get. Obviously, the Russian efforts in Kiev to destabilize and make a lot of divisions in Orange Ukraine were very successful, and obviously they worked with all the methods they could. It ended already in 2008, more or less, and in 2010, no surprise, they put their guy back into power. Here comes also this American connection, because also parallel a lot of efforts were done in America to get the expertise and get the networks. Obviously, America is the number one power, you don't have to explain it, and to the ex-Soviet experts, yeah, they knew that very well, and they worked on it, and they got this Manafort guy, who was now pardoned by Trump. He plays a crucial role in the whole story of the Second Cold War. He is obviously a traitor to America and to the free world. Yeah, he worked already then. He is a kind of a political soldier of fortune. He and all his associates, he worked already in Ukraine to get Yanukovych back in power. It was then achieved in 2010, and it's no surprise that he had a lot of complicity from various people. And so what happened then? He achieved to have this kleptocracy established. He got filthy rich in the process, and he should not have a pardon, but he should be lifelong in jail. Yeah? He is really one of the worst characters we have in this period of our generation. And no, what happened, of course, Yanukovych is extremely incapable and incompetent and personally greedy, tacky personality. You know, in this 3.5 years or 4 years until he was in power again, in this 2010, 12, 13, until he left in February, fled in 2014, he was stealing as much as he could, built up a really very corrupt, but I'm talking about unbelievable corrupt system of permanent stealing and institutionalized corruption. It was a complete disaster. And he then fled with a lot of money. The estimated volume of loss is about 40 billion, might be more, might be less. But ultimately, he was a complete disaster. I was personally in his villa in this monastery, in this former monastery, where he built his kind of luxury palace, and where he has also built this kind of party boat, quite an interesting feature, where you sit all these marble tables and all is very tacky, and you know, this poker table. It's like a 19th century oligarch vision of the Wild West mixed up with some Central Asian dictatorship style, yeah? All with this fake gold, you know, and expensive stones, and you know, it was really a very bizarre thing. He was himself, the estimated cost was $10 million, I was told, and it is really a site now. It's now a museum for corruption, or anti-corruption, and whenever you are in Kiev, you should visit that. So that was his kind of style, that was his kind of reign, and you know, it was a complete disaster. And it ended also as tragically as it could, where a lot of people had to die in order to remove him from power. So, but I will talk in the third episode about this period of the Cold War, of the Second Cold War, the period of 2012 to today, and probably a decade to come. But now I want to talk about exactly what happened then in this enlargement year of 2004. And then in November came the Orange Ukraine, and then the important year 2005 and 2006. Yeah, of course, Iraq was still such a high agenda item. John McCain doing the search and all these things happening in the second period, in the second mandate of George Bush's presidency. You might remember he was not very popular in Europe, and we in Austria, I apologize, I was ashamed to see it. Hundreds and thousands of people demonstrating against him when he was visiting in 2008. And it was really one of the low points of our transatlantic partnership. And everybody in Austria believed they are an expert for Iraq, and that Saddam Hussein was a really cool guy to keep. Yeah? Anyhow, I was one of the few, so already at then, a few people in Austria who already at that time criticized very much our politics as anti-American, neutralism, and complicitly with the Iraqi dictatorship. But okay, that is not very popular positions to take. Anyhow, what happened then was obviously, and this is now the very important point, it is the Bucharest summit. At the end of his term in 2008, it was also the issue of legacy and, you know, what lasting impact. And obviously, the Americans saw the world really in geostrategic terms. Ukraine to be awarded and to join the NATO, that would have, of course, avoided the war in Ukraine later, and also to have Georgia in NATO. That was the big issue, and also Macedonia, don't forget. It was the three countries which were rejected at this terrible Bucharest summit. Not completely terrible, because it was at least possible to have Croatia and Albania in NATO. That is historic. Thank you very much, America, for securing these two countries. Thank you very much, George Bush, for making that possible. But obviously, you know, he tried very much with North Macedonia. No, that was Macedonia. Then came the Greek delegation, a very incapable prime minister, very full of himself, blocking this one. And, you know, then later ended in total disaster. But obviously the more significant geostrategic issues were the Ukrainian and the Georgian debacle, because Bush really tried to get it. Putin, who was himself in Bucharest, there's this famous photos of this dinner together. And then the Germans and the French, who are supposedly knowing Russia well and have always, you know, this kind of partly fear of Russia, partly this business case with Russia, and also this kind of really bad conscience about the Second World War and Russia, which is the Soviet Union myth, that it is all only Russia, 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 as if Ukraine would not have been part of the Soviet Union at that time, and most of the victims coming from Ukraine in the Second World War, and under the Stalin dictatorship, by the way. But nevertheless, the Bucharest summit on Eastern Europe ended in a disaster. And, you know, this was in April 2008, and in August already came the Georgian War, the invasion of Russia, of two regions, and they were stopped in the moment because they had the intention to go to Tiflis as well, always blaming Shakishvili and his supposed aggression, but in reality preparing this invasion, I'm sure, already from the moment of this Bucharest summit, because they had to destroy the integrity of Georgia, and they knew that these two breakaway regions are like these entry points into that, in order to make sure that Georgia cannot easily join NATO. And that definitely was the aim of the whole military operation in 2008 in the summer, during the so-called Olympian peace. Yeah? So that is how it was. And so Georgia really played a big role. Obviously, you know, then came the Sarkozy mission and, you know, this European peacemaking, yes, and so. And suddenly they had no big impact on the situation, but at least, you know, in a way, of course, Putin could portray himself as not going to Tiflis and being reasonable and just going to his region. That was his myth. He never actually wanted to occupy Tiflis, I'm sure, because occupation gives a lot of responsibilities and a lot of headache and a lot of costs. Yeah, he wanted to occupy South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and that is what he did. And he wanted to make a point that there shall be no further NATO enlargement in the former Soviet Union. And, you know, the peacers in Western Europe didn't need this explanation because they understood that message from the beginning. That's why they opposed George Bush at the end of his presidency, already in Bucharest. And so the whole disaster of the escalation of this first phase of the Cold War was going ahead. And obviously it was already also visible that there was this transition of power or this kind of rochade in Russia. That was also an important point because 2008 is one of these difficult years where you have an election in America. So a lot of global instability automatically comes in these years because the lead power of the world is in a kind of handover position. And also in Russia, it was this transfer of power where Medvedev was moving into the presidency and Putin stayed on as a prime minister. But obviously, there was this was itchy in the beginning. They really didn't know how to handle that very well. They contradicted themselves in publics, and it took some time for Putin to box Medvedev in this corner, get rich, but be silent, yeah? And you will be fine. So ultimately, that later developed, and Putin planned already, I'm confident, his third term, which he then took in 2012, and all the complications of the white winter, the protest of the Russian middle class and the students against this kind of retaking of an old Soviet apparatchnik in this new incarnation to retake the power, and all this acrimony about it, which made also the third term of Putin much more bitter and much harder and much more determined again to lead this second Cold War in a more decisive and crucial phase, which ultimately he did. I want to mention, and this is important in this context as well, to understand that we have basically also parallel Cold Wars, if you want to see it, in smaller versions, also with parts of the Arab world, and they were very hot in the 2000s, and also with China. So the strategy was again to be softer on China. That worked very well. It was obviously taking China in the WTO, which is so multiple to the GDP of China, which was part of the strategy because the focus of the Americans was in the Arab world in the 2000s. And so it happened. Ultimately, the big speeches, democracy in the Arab world, the freedom agenda of Bush, but also Obama in Cairo. And then it started all this Arab Spring, basically initiated, not what many think, by American Secret Service, no, but by American presidents talking about freedom and people reading, people believing, people again seeing the prosperity differential, the sclerosis, the disaster of these Arab socialist countries. And then one by one broke from Tunisia to Libya and to Syria, in Iran, and many of them had this kind of specific revolutions. Some went good, some went bad. The West didn't really have an answer then institutionally. There was no wisdom to include them in the OECD, no, in the OSCD. That would have been very wise. There was too less kind of assistance for the democratic movement. And we had major situations in Egypt and obviously the disaster which will determine the Second Cold War, obviously in Syria from 2011 on, Syria always being a Russian client state, and Russia then in this situation also not determined to lose it, yeah, and the proxy Assad and the assets attached. Yeah. So that was, of course, a really big new stage of this Second Cold War. And this was happening during Putin's prime ministership, yeah? And he couldn't do exactly what he wanted in this moment because of this careful balancing. And he also didn't see exactly how it could happen. But it was in Tunisia quite successful. But then happened the 2011 situation with Gaddafi and the civil war and the Western intervention on the side of the democratic forces and the rebels against Gaddafi, and the intervention to kill Gaddafi ultimately. And of course, Gaddafi being the big hero of the socialist world for so long, and for the Arabs and for Africa, socialist, he was the big, big long-term factor of stability and generosity, because Libya gives a lot of opportunities with its oil fortune to do a lot of nonsense and do a lot of harm. and he did considerable of it. And so ultimately he ended in this way in 2011. And obviously, you know, at that stage, the Libyan intervention already, but also the emerging civil war in Syria, was a huge geostrategic instability phase. Putin decided to run the third term, and then he won it. The Russian middle class protesting, Clinton making her big statements for democracy in Russia. And, you know, that was the framework where we are today. And then started the full escalation with his third term, when he was determined not to let, in his way, in his thinking, the West win the Arab Spring and intervene more and more. And this kind of paranoia which you develop when you're too long in power, you see all the world being against you. And this paranoia with the White Russian situation, or the White Winter, not White Russian, but White Winter, and the Libyan situation and Syria led to this kind of escalation, where Putin was, in my view, already very determined to lead an even stronger second phase of the Second Cold War, which he declared in 2007. But he could not really do so much, you know, just one war in Georgia, that was for him already a big thing. And then in 2012, when he came back, he was determined to put a stop to, in his view, Western expansionism in the world. And so we have this kind of hot phase of the Second Cold War, starting with the return of Putin to the third presidency and the situation in Libya, Syria escalating. And then obviously the Ukrainian and Crimean crisis, which I will discover, which I will describe in the next part of this podcast series. So thanks a lot for your attention. Excuse again my, how can I say, my Austrian English. Yeah? And, you know, I hope you find it informative and useful. And I thank you very much for your attention. And I will prepare the next series now, in the hottest phase of the Cold War, from 2014 onwards, what happened in Ukraine and Syria and how we really got there. But I will start with the great withdrawal of America, with the Rose Garden speech, and with the moment Obama in 2013 gave away the leadership of the free world and of the world in general, which America ultimately could have, should have. And if it has, it's of course a much better world. But Obama unfortunately gave it away in August 2013. And that's why we are in this 7 years crisis now. Thanks a lot for your attention.